We're in the middle of a series on Revelation, and I'd like to share with you the next installment from what Danielle shared from last week that I've entitled Persecution, the Kingdom, and Resistance. Persecution, the Kingdom, and Resistance. However, as soon as I sent that email out yesterday, I wanted to change the title to the Church's Bimillennial Performance Review. And that would become a little bit more apparent as time goes on. I'd like to share with you the key verse here in Revelation chapter 1, verse 9, which introduces essentially the preface for what John wants to do throughout the rest of this letter. And again, it is a letter. Danielle shared a little bit about demythologizing, taking it out of the left behind context, and we're trying to re-enter into the historical, cultural, linguistic context of what this letter was. Once again, asking the question first, what did it mean to them? Before we ask the question, what does it mean to us? And here, John makes pretty clear here, I, John, your brother, who share with you. So John is a comrade, a friend, somebody who's with you in community, in these things, in Jesus. Three things. The persecution, that's number one. And that persecution, by the way, commentators have suggested, scholars have suggested, both the current and future. We haven't gone into deep history, but during this late stage of the first century, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian have now become emperors. And their rule and reign becomes more and more oppressive of people who are not following Roman rule and reign. So the persecution, and John is expecting this to continue. So he's going to share in the persecution and the kingdom. Now, if you've been around Spark for a little while, you know that the kingdom is about the rule and the reign of God. But this may actually be the rule and the reign of anybody. What rule and reign? In fact, the rule and the reign of somebody is actually the key thing that's in question. Who is actually in charge? And then this great phrase, and patient endurance, which we are going to retranslate non-violent resistance. So John, your brother, shares with you in these three things. There's a persecution, there's a rule and a reign, there's a way in which this world works, and then there is those of us who are non-violently resisting all of that, the persecution and the rule and reign. So that's why the title has come. We can also translate that phrase, resistance. Now, this is completely in line with what Danielle shared with you all last week. The biggest problem facing the church today is Babylon, and we need to form a Babylonian hermeneutic, hold fast to the covenant way of Jesus, and remember the beginning and the end of the story. Honestly, in summation, Revelation, she did it. That's it. The rest of the story is just details about various emperors, historical events, four horsemen of the apocalypse. I understand. There's some scary stuff in there. The dragon, the beast, the seven hills and all that kind of thing. But this is the core of it. And the core of it is if you can stay steadfast and resist the persecution, the kingdom, and do so nonviolently, you will succeed. You will conquer. You will overcome. What I'd like to do is take a little bit of a twist to it as we begin in this first and second chapter of Revelation, introducing the seven cities. Now, the reason why I think that's important is because what have we been doing for the past, 13 years of Spark? We've been talking about gardens. Gardens over and over again. The Garden of Eden, the Garden of Revelation, the gardens that are found in between. I mean, Danielle has shared with us multiple ways in which the garden manifests itself as the very presence of God, the good things, the way in which Jesus intended for life to happen. All the good things happen in the garden. But here in Revelation, we're not in a garden. We're not persecuted in a garden. There's no rule and reign in the garden. Where are we? We're not in a garden. We're in a what? We're in a city. We're in a very different kind of life. We're in Asia Minor, technological advancements, Greco-Roman cultural advancements. The context of Revelation, and really the context of the New Testament, all of this stuff, now finds herself in this, industrialized, built, concrete, streets, roads, and all of the things that come with this. And one of the things that I don't think we quite fully stop to consider is just how radically different the city is from the garden. And one of the reasons why, we all live in the city. And we take it for granted. And we just try to figure out, how do we live faithfully as followers of Jesus with all of the accoutrements, the accommodations, technological advancements, the goodness that comes from the city. How many of you have running water? Is your refrigerator running? You better go catch it. How many of you have all the things that the city provides? We don't even think about it anymore. And what I'm going to propose to you is that John, writing to the churches in the cities of Ephesus, Smyrna, Thyatira, Philadelphia, etc., he's pointing out something very, very subtly about what's going on there and why it's important for us to pay attention. Because like every single one of us, including myself, boy, was I looking in the mirror preparing this, is that we don't think very much about what the city has done and continues to do to us. And because we don't really think and consider that maybe there's some exploration there from a spiritual standpoint, from our core value standpoint. And I believe my proposal to you for your consideration is that John is writing to the churches in those cities because those churches were once in the garden in a very different kind of village life. And they have now been transplanted into highly cosmopolitan, highly technologically advanced, metropolitan kinds of living. And the reason why I think this is important is because people have done some studies as to what the city has done. Lewis Mumford is one of my favorite authors on this. We will not go through all 900 pages of his work. But there is a quote in his book, The Culture of Cities. Mind takes form in the city. And in turn, urban forms conditioned mind. Your mind takes form in the city. And in turn, urban forms condition mind. You cannot live in the city without the city conditioning who you are, how you think, your worldview, your perceptions, etc. And I know this is lengthy. I love this kind of writing, so I'm sharing it with you. I hope you appreciate it as well. For space, no less than time, is artfully reorganized in cities, in boundary lines and silhouettes, in the fixing of horizontal planes and vertical peaks, in utilizing or denying the natural site. The city records the attitude of a culture. I love that line. And an epoch to the fundamental facts of existence. The dome and the spire, the open avenue and the closed court tell the story not merely of different physical accommodations, but of essentially different conceptions of humanity's destiny. The city is both a physical utility for collective living and a symbol of those collective purposes and unanimities that arise under such favoring circumstance. In short, let me see if I can sum it up for you. Cities are living organisms that influence, shape, mold, form, and in many ways govern our beliefs, our views, our understandings, and our values. And you cannot live in a city without being shaped and molded, your mind, your heart, your worldview, your perceptions, without it being molded by the city in which you live. Let me try a couple things here. Every city usually has a personality. And that personality can take on different forms in different ways. What do you think of when you think of New York? What its characteristics, its central reason for existence? What comes to mind? What is it known for?
Pizza.
It's all buildings.
It's energy. Wall Street.
Yes. Wall Street, density, okay.
Never sleep.
Well, that's another city too, Las Vegas, that we'll get to. Yes, all of those things. So immediately something comes to mind, right? This is just two that I've chosen, but you've selected some others. It's a financial and media hub. What do you think of when you think of Los Angeles?
Entertainment.
Entertainment. Yeah, smog. Well, they've actually cleaned that up pretty well recently due to some wonderful advancements. But entertainment. San Francisco. Tech and Silicon. See? Just the naming of the city gives you a sense of culture, identity, purpose, meaning. Isn't this amazing? Nashville. I mean, there's no, what else comes to mind when you think of Nashville? And then, of course, Las Vegas. What is gambling, wealth, opulence, the city that also never sleeps? Yeah, exactly. This is the city where your pastor got married. Which poses some serious questions about your leadership, let me just say.
Who married her there?
Yeah, it's clearly not thinking. The idea that the city takes on a personality or a culture or an identity that shapes the people who live there is also found in our own backyard. Does anybody remember this transition after COVID? When downtown Mountain View, Castro Street, was obviously a very bustling city, very active, and there's Castro Street was an open lane for traffic, highway traffic. And then when COVID hit, of course, everything changed. So they shut down the streets, they shut down, I mean, everybody was going through chaos. And what they did is they opened up the streets in order to create more spaces for people to enjoy food, et cetera, put games out, all those different types of things. What happened after? When COVID essentially kind of faded into the distance, what did we want? We wanted to keep it. The shape of the city did something to us. Now, I don't know if we could necessarily articulate it, but something changed within our psyche, within our mind, within our heart. And I will tell you, this is what I felt. Walking down Castro before, it was like a busy, like it wasn't as welcoming. There was traffic, there's safety concerns, all the things that subconsciously govern how you think about Castro Street. As soon as this happened, and I began to walk down the middle of the street, and I got to see cornhole and people's busking on the street, people eating out, walking, enjoying. It felt like I was a part of a community again or something. And it was safe. They blocked off the traffic. Something happened. Something changed. The city began to mold more and more of my spirit. I want to, if you're interested, this is just a little footnote for those of you. Jane Jacobs has written a phenomenal book on urban planning called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And what happened in Castro is essentially a beautiful manifestation of what she wrote about in the early 20th century. This idea of the city taking some sort of impression on your heart and your soul and your mind is also true in other kinds of ways. Let me ask you this. What do you feel when you look at this? Or how many of you have had those moments where you get out of the city and you start driving down Highway 1 along the coast and there's no buildings, there's no traffic, there's no bustle, there's no light pollution? What happens to you? I will tell you, for years, for those of you who know that my in-laws live in Santa Rosa, I have told Danielle, I can watch your body change as soon as we get out of San Francisco, up into Marin County, up to San, something happens to your demeanor, to your spirit, when you're all of a sudden out of the hustle and bustle of this particular place. The city forms the mind, the heart, the spirit. All of this around you influences who you are, how you think, your worldview, your values, your feelings, your emotions. And cities, as organic instruments, take on new meanings and new ideas, new values, most explicitly and most beautifully found in Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, I'm in Minneapolis, I hear your voice singing through the bloody mist. Here in our home, they killed
and those of you who've been following the news, you know.
In the winter of
Minneapolis is no longer just a city in Minnesota. The city of Minneapolis now has taken on a new cultural identity, a new place in our national consciousness, so much so that Bruce Springsteen wrote an entire song about Minneapolis. My friends, my proposal to you is simply this. Cities are living organisms that influence, shape, mold, form, and in many ways govern our beliefs, our views, our understandings, and our values. And for those of us who live in Silicon Valley, we don't ever stop to think about this, but it is absolutely true. It's been true throughout history, and it's true still today. Lewis Mumford, in his work, writes this. What you do in the city becomes who you are. This is no longer just about pure physical residence. It is about identity. It is also about values. It's also about the kind of world you want to bring about. So, if that happens to be the case, which I propose it is, then my question for you, my friends, is when John begins to write to the churches and he identifies very, very clearly these seven cities, I'm going to suggest to you that there's a reason why he's identifying. Look, the church by the 90s AD, the church, the capital C church, has spread all over the place. It's all over Asia Minor. It's all over Greece. It's definitely all over Northern Africa. I'm beginning to head out into the world. And in John's revelation, at least at this particular stage, he's writing specifically to cities. Now, we're going to just very, very briefly, there's no way we can go over this. This is like a lifetime of study. But one of the things you need to understand, just like Nashville, Las Vegas, San Jose, San Francisco, Los Angeles, built on a particular idea. So these cities also were built on very similar kinds of cultural pillars.
We built this city!
So Ephesus was built, let me just say, all of these cities were built with cosmopolitan Greco-Roman ideas. But each specific city also had its own characteristic. Ephesus was the official temple warden of Artemis. It was a major port city for international trade. That's also the Library of Celsus, a great educational center. Smyrna.
We built this city!
You're gonna hear that seven times.
Sit tight. Sit tight, Anne. There's five more coming. When I was preparing this, I was wondering at what particular church somebody was going to get disgusted with this idea. I see two. That was it. Two's your limit. Smyrna was also a harbor city. It had a temple to Zeus. It was also a cultural and urban development city. Say it all with me.
We built this city.
Thank you very much. Pergamum, it was an intellectual hub. It also was a medical center. The emperor also placed his political center at Pergamum, which is going to be very interesting because John is going to say the seat of Satan is also at Pergamum. It was known for its brilliant architecture. Thyatira.
We built this city.
We built this city.
Oh, sorry. It was a manufacturing center. I know, I'm sorry, my bad. Dye industry was a worship center of Apollo, the god of light. Sardis, this is an amazing one.
We built this city!
Sardis was actually built on a hill, and it was incredibly secure. So Sardis was incredibly wealthy and apathetic. They didn't care about anybody else because they had everything. Kind of like when you build, you know, on the hill. And then Philadelphia.
We built this city!
Built that city where there was a lot of earthquake activity, a lot of seismic activity. And one of the things that characterized Philadelphia, very much like Japan, by the way, Japan is built on a lot of seismic activity, very much so just like that. In addition to being a Greco-Roman cultural center, it also was known for disaster resilience. It knew how to take care of one another. And last one, Laodicea.
We built this city!
Thank you very much. Okay, you're done. We're done. Was a medical school. They actually had an eye salve that they thought was good for medical treatments. Textile houses, banking, they were very self-sufficient and they had a phenomenal water system, both from Colossae, from the river, the Lycus River Valley, from Colossae as well as from Hierapolis, where they had some hot water springs. Each and every one of these cities has its own characteristics, has its own features. And so when these churches are residing there, here's my proposal, and we can see it in the letter. Something about living in those cities has influenced how those Christians lived. Something about living in a place where there's a lot of self-sufficiency, influenced what they believed their faith was. Something about living in a place where you didn't need to worry about anybody, there's a lot of wealth and I'm fine and protected, influenced how they thought their faith should be expressed. And so the question is, when the church begins to go out into these cities, how are they doing? And what I'm going to propose to you is that the reviews are mixed. And the reason why John writes what he does, and he says, write this and send it to all the cities, is because you're doing some amazing things, and I'm incredibly proud of you for this, but you really stink at this. Which is why I'm proposing that Revelation is actually the church's bimillennial performance review. I think we're due for one in 50 years. How many of you have ever received a performance review? You know that performance reviews are incredibly fun. And they generally come with particular kinds of ratings. This is exactly what John is doing. Watch this. To the angel of the church in Ephesus, right? These are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands. I know your works, your toil. I know your patient endurance. I know that you cannot tolerate evildoers. You have tested those who claim to be apostles but are not and have found them to be false. Congratulations, you have exceeded expectations. Oh, by the way, I know that you are also patiently enduring. There's that same word of resistance. And bearing up for the sake of my name. And you have not grown weary. Oh, man, you are far exceeding expectations. Congratulations. But I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love you had at first. This needs some serious improvement. He goes on to then write, remember then from what you have fallen, repent and do the works you did at first. If not, I will come to you and remove your lampstand, the menorah, from its place until you repent. John is saying to the church in Ephesus, you've got some work to do. So I think it's time for a performance improvement plan. Thank you for reading. I'm really proud of this slide. Remember, repent. And if you take a look at the city of Ephesus, it's one of the most spectacular, well-developed, technologically advanced, highly culturally engaged cities. You can imagine how you might lose that thing that first drew you. The seduction. Man, we didn't even talk about Hellenism before we got here. The issue, Hellenism is the center bingo square in Maya's card for any of Kevin's teachings, so that's why she's laughing at me. So Maya, Hellenism, ding, ding, ding. We didn't even talk about Hellenism, the idea that Greek culture and ideas and religion, philosophies, etc., they don't come in and say, you must believe these things. They seduce you. They say, hey, you want to go watch this guy throw a rock? It's amazing. Hey, you want to go study these ancient philosophers? By the way, naked? And if you ever grew up in a good old Israelite city and town and you heard these kinds, hey, do you want to go watch this famous actor put on the best performance you've ever seen at the theater? You go, yeah, I want to see that. I've never seen anything like that. And this seduces you. So you can imagine people living in Ephesus, the church living in Ephesus, the disciples of Jesus who have been commissioned to take this movement and move it into the world, living in the city of Ephesus, might go, hey, that, well, yeah, let's go do that. Sure, you know, there's a game on. Sounds like fun. You see what's happening? The city has its own morals, its own way of being, its own set of values. And when you live in the city, you are influenced by that. And part of what's happening here is that John is trying to course correct. Listen, I know you have resisted, I know you've tested false prophets. I'm so proud of you for that. But you've also lost something. You've lost your first love. And then he ends, this is to your credit. You hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. By the way, that meets expectations. Good job. That's the minimal. You're supposed to hate the Nicolaitans. And at this particular point, if you ask who they are, I have no idea. If you go through these letters very carefully. Oh, last one, Anne. Last one. That was a joke. If you go through these letters very carefully and these exhortations, you start to see, yeah, there's some things that are good, there's some things that are bad. Smyrna, hey, listen, you're enduring affliction and slander, but don't fear. Pergamum, by the way, here's what I mentioned before, the political center may have been Satan's throne, the reference to Satan's throne because of the emperor holding his political center there. Listen, you're holding to my name. You're not denying the faith. But you know what? You also tolerate this Balaam guy and his teachings, and they're causing people to eat food sacrificed to idols. Stop that. Thyatira, your love, your faith, your servant, your patient endurance. But here's the problem. You tolerate Jezebel and the deep things of Satan. Something about this city has seduced you. Sardis, you're dead. Wake up. There's no thing. Listen, this is all performance improvement plan. There is no good in Sardis. And I find that to be incredibly insightful in a city that feels like it needs nothing. Philadelphia actually is not doing too bad in a city of which there's disaster resilience. You know how to overcome. And then in Laodicea, there's only bad things to say. You're neither hot or cold. And he says, don't you understand? You're wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked, which is all of the elements of Laodicea, perhaps one of the most explicit examples of the city having overtaken the mind. My friends, the fundamental message that John is suggesting, commensurate with what Pastor Danielle shared last week, conquer, endure, resist. Yes, you live in the city. Yes, you are influenced by the world around you. Do not give up in your patient endurance. Do not give up in conquering and overcoming those aspects of the city that are seducing you away from the core commitment of your faith. Cities are living organisms that influence, shape, mold, form, and in many ways govern our beliefs, views, understandings, and value. Is it possible that living as a follower of Jesus in a city can compromise the core ethics and values of the faith? Is that possible? My proposal to you, my friends, is not only is it possible, but that's exactly what happens if you do not stay vigilant. Brian Blount, in his commentary on Revelation, writes this. If John was asking his people to stand up, in other words, witness, and to stand out in the world, and that had accepted them, he was essentially telling them to go out and pick a fight. He was ordering them to declare that they were now non-accommodating Christ believers who could no longer participate in a world that had not previously noticed them since they had heretofore been accommodating to it. The church had been simply accommodating the culture around them. Fine. If this is how you think life should be, that's fine. That is somehow compatible. And what Brian Blount is saying is that John is exhorting the church to say, stop accommodating. Do not participate any longer. Wake up and recognize. I'd like to propose a question. If John were writing to the church in Silicon Valley, by the way, this, I think, we could have discussions on for a long, long time. If John was writing to the church in Silicon Valley, what would he write? I know your deeds. I know you participate in these activities. I know your love for justice. I know your care in your community. I know your long commutes and your ever endurance to maintain close community with one. But I have this against you. Silicon Valley. fill in the blank. You thought I was going to say something, didn't you? Yeah, you were ready for it. I think I have, personally, a lot of things that I could say. Now, that's Silicon Valley, but the question is, will the church accommodate what this city is doing? So, my friends, this is the persecution, the kingdom, and the patient endurance, the resistance. This is what this book, what this letter is exhorting us to consider. Because what you do in this city becomes who you are. People without faith live in the city, do as the city does, allows the city to take its mark and its shape. Followers of Jesus who live in the city don't. They live by a different ethic, a higher sense of conscientiousness, a core set of values that say, you know, when the city does this, we can't accommodate that. Because that violates the very sense of humanity, that violates the very sense of our story. And there are moments, we could talk about this for a long time, where the church and so many cities across have absolutely accommodated. And part of what this Revelation story is encouraging, exhorting us, challenging us to consider is we're no longer going to accommodate. Your core commitment is not to just simply take on the wonderful blessings and benefits of the city. Your core commitment is a disciple of Jesus who suffered and died at the hands of the city. So that's a very different message and a very different challenge and a very different exhortation. What you do in the city becomes who you are. So my encouragement is for us to wrestle with this question, what do we now do in this city? And is our core commitment to simply accommodate the glorious riches of Silicon Valley? Trust me, I don't need to say that. Of course, there are glorious riches in the Silicon Valley. Or do we recognize that there is an accommodation that is a compromise of the movement of Jesus? One of the things that we do in the city every single week is we take communion. Why? Because we remember that this symbol, this ritual, reminds us of this Jesus every single week. So as we sing and as we take communion, please remind yourself that you are taking these elements and you are recommitting to this covenant in this city. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed, and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." One of the things the church does in the city is to welcome everybody and anybody, regardless of how accommodating you've been. So if you are here, you are our guest. This is not our table. This is God's table. This is Christ's table. And all of you are welcome to partake. Please come as we sing.